Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a GOP letter to Iran. Hillary Clinton meets the press. Two police shot in Ferguson. Freshman Republican Senator Tom Cotton doubled down on the letter 47 Republican senators sent to Iran on the administration's nuclear negotiations.
We need to be crystal clear with the leaders of Iran. Any deal that's not approved by Congress won't be accepted by Congress. Not now, and certainly not in the future.
At a press conference at the UN, Hillary Clinton defended her use of private email as Secretary of State.
Looking back, it would have been better for me to use two separate phones and two email accounts. I thought using one device would be simpler, and obviously it hasn't worked out that way.
And two police officers shot in Ferguson, Missouri. Here's the gunfire caught on cell phone video and St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar.
This is really an ambush, is what it is. I mean, you know, you can't see it coming, you don't understand that it's going to happen, and you're basically defenseless.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ryan Grimm of the Huffington Post, Nedra Pickler of the Associated Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking about the Republican senator's letter, about Hillary Clinton's defense, Ferguson, the University of Oklahoma this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Ryan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also in Washington, Nedra Pickler, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Nedra, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ryan, and Nedra.
Let's go straight to John Kerry's outrage, I guess is not too strong a word, over the letter sent by 47, signed by 47 GOP senators. It was an open letter addressed to the leadership of Iran. Here he was on Wednesday talking with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
My reaction to the letter was utter disbelief. During my 29 years here in the Senate, I never heard of, nor even heard of it being proposed, anything comparable to this. If I had, I can guarantee you, no matter what the issue and no matter who was president, I would have certainly rejected it.
John Kerry, who, of course, was a longtime U.S. senator himself, here's Republican Senator Rand Paul at that same hearing on Wednesday defending the GOP letter.
I signed this letter because I signed it to an administration that doesn't listen. To an administration that every turn tries to go around Congress because you think you can't get your way.
Nedra Pickler, what's the White House response? We hear John Kerry right there. How is the White House absorbing this letter sent over the top of the negotiation efforts addressed to the leadership of Iran saying, don't go there unless we go there? How's the White House dealing with it?
They're very outraged about this. Joe Biden also put out a lengthy and unusually harsh statement against his former Senate colleagues, saying that the letter offended him. You know, this represents a real new low, I think, between the White House and congressional Republicans. Their relationships have not been good at all during the president's tenure, but the White House just sees this as crossing a line. You know, normally foreign policy isn't such a partisan issue, and they don't usually expect such partisan attacks on something like this. White House spokesman Josh Earnest actually called this a rush to war in response to what the senators had to say.
I mean, Ryan Grimm, for a long time we talked about dissent ending at the water's edge or beginning there. Foreign policy was supposed to be where Americans united and united behind their president. Now, we had the leader of Israel in front of the joint session of Congress just days ago rejecting this as well. Who are these senators following here? Where are they headed?
Well, what you've sort of seen form over the last couple of weeks is kind of a two-party Likud Republican coalition that is trying to, both of them trying to blow up this deal with Iran.
And what's important, Likud being the party of the Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel.
That's right. And what's important to remember here is that Tom Cotton, who was the organizer of this letter, the 47 Republicans, has said on the record that he wants these negotiations to fail. You know, he has said that the negotiations getting blown up by congressional action is a feature, not a bug, of their strategy. So he has been unusually honest, and I think that's because he's only been in the Senate for a couple months. He'll learn that you're not supposed to be that direct with what you say. But when you understand that context, seeing these 47 Republicans say on the record that their intent is to destroy these negotiations raises the question, well, what is your strategy? The only other thing you could do to try to slow Iran down is to strike them. And it's remarkable that, you know, when it comes to making war, the Republican Party right now wants the executive to have as much authority as possible. In fact, they're trying to stop Obama from even putting any restrictions on the authorization of the use of force. But when it comes to making peace, all of a sudden there have to be all kinds of tight controls around what the executive can do. And it ought to be either the executive has, you know, foreign policy control or it doesn't.
Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding here? Does this look like something that could derail the negotiations? And what about Senator Rand Paul's critique? We heard it right there on tape that it is the White House that's taking unusual liberty in the way it's negotiating this potential agreement.
Well, you know, that sort of thing has a precedent as well. I mean, Woodrow Wilson lost the Versailles Treaty in the Senate because in the League of Nations because he wouldn't bring in the opposition, would let them play no role in the forming of his negotiations. And but it's hard to imagine what the president could have done to bring more Republicans in. He did accept severe Republican-led sanctions on Iran. So he went as far as he could then. I think I'm struck today by Michael Gerson's column. Gerson, former speechwriter for George W. Bush,
yes,
says, in timing, tone, and substance, the letter raises questions about the Republican majority's capacity to govern. That comes back again to what we've seen in domestic matters, that they seem more interested in demonstrating and in roiling their base than in actually governing. And here they've made it sort of anti-governing. They're trying to sabotage an agreement. The only bright spot from the president's point of view is that apparently Robert Menendez, the Democrat from New Jersey, was within two votes of having a veto-proof bipartisan majority that would require Senate approval of an Iran deal. But that was before the Cotton letter. And now the feeling is he may not have that because Democrats just see how toxic the partisanship is and that may actually cause backfire on the Cotton strategy.
Nedra, what are you hearing at the White House? You're covering it for the AP. Do they think they can still get an agreement with this kind of resistance already in the air before they've even got anything hammered out?
Right. I mean, even before this letter, they were saying that they thought probably the prospects of an agreement were less than 50%. They haven't said directly that these have damaged the talks, but they do say that they impact them. And we've seen some European diplomats who are involved in these negotiations expressing unease about the letter. They're basically suggesting that the United States and its partners, this letter suggests that they lack credibility at the negotiating table. And, you know, these talks are at a really delicate phase. There's a date approaching here at the end of March where they're supposed to have an interim agreement for a framework and then the June 30th deadline for a final deal. So this comes at a really critical time.
Ryan, what about the authorization of use of military force? This is, of course, for the Iraq setting against the Islamic State. We've seen a lot of fighting going on there this week around Tikrit, some success by Iraqi central government forces there, but heavily backed by militias and heavily backed by Iran. I mean, between this dissension in Washington over the talks with Iran and Iran taking the lead in Tikrit, you can see a kind of crippled superpower here.
Right. It's quite striking that while the Republicans are sending letters to Iran, sort of acting as collaborators with the hardliners there who are trying to destroy the deal, at the same time, Iran is our ally in Iraq at the moment. What a lot of people may not know is that the Iraqi government more or less serves at the pleasure of the Iranian government at this point. And when there was a recent transition, that could only happen with the blessing of the Iranian government. A few months ago, we reported that Iran has been bombing the Islamic State in Iraq with the full knowledge of the United States, and the United States is okay with that. And obviously, we all know that that the Iranians and the kind of Iranian-funded and sponsored and affiliated militias in Iraq are now taking on the Islamic State, along with some elements of the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Iraqi military, and we're okay with that. We are essentially allied with Iran.
Maybe if it helps get the Islamic State defeated or contained, maybe that's all right. But what about the authorization for U.S. use of military force, if necessary? Where does Congress stand in that discussion that's been going in opposite directions?
It's quite a confusing thing for people to understand from the outside, because there is a current authorization of the use of force that is in place that was passed after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, which both presidents since then have said more or less allows them to do anything they want to do that has anything to do with the war on terror. Now, the president has offered to kind of restrict that original authorization, as long as there would be some new authorization to go after the Islamic State.
But is he going to get it? The Republicans want it to be pretty wide open authority. Democrats have been resisting that. Is something moving forward or not?
Everything that moves forward winds up becoming partisanized in this Congress, and anything that needs to go through both chambers and get signed by the president, you're better off betting against it at this moment.
Jack, how do you know when a country is at the outer limits of polarized paralysis? Do we have the evidence on the table now?
I mean, it seems to me you do, where you have, a negotiations that which really could, if they fail, lead to war. That not the negotiations, but the failure are same. And you've got a 47 senators, including people who are grown-ups and adults, signing this letter by a young senator who's been there, I think, 60 days. I watched his debate in the last campaign. And he's a military officer, Harvard grad.
Tom Cotton out of Arkansas. Jack, we're up against the break right here. Please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. Jack Beatty, Nedra Pickler of the Associated Press covering the White House, Ryan Grimm with the Huffington Post. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking this hour at a week in the news, the GOP's Iran letter, Hillary Clinton meets the press, police shot in Ferguson. Behind us right here, explosions rocking to Crete as Iraqi troops and Shiite militiamen advanced on Wednesday. They have made progress against the Islamic State, but that fight is not over, and there's a much bigger one waiting. Ryan Grimm is with us this hour, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Nedra Pickler, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Lots of callers on Iran and the Senate. Shannon in Iowa City. Iowa, Shannon, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a quick question for you. Where does the Logan Act play into all this with these 47 senators that wrote this or signed off on this letter? Would that or could that play into anything for these senators for any kind of repercussion?
Logan Act, this goes back to 1799, prohibits unauthorized citizens from negotiating with foreign governments during a dispute with the United States.
Logan, yep.
What's your judgment on that, Shannon?
Well, I feel that, obviously there are senators, they've been voted in, but at the same time, this is the White House's kind of place to be making these deals or even talking with them at this point, I feel. And I feel that they kind of overstepped their bounds by doing what they've done.
Shannon, let me pick it up with Nedra Pickler right here, if I may. Nedra, what about it? The law and precedent here, the White House very critical of these senators, but you heard Rand Paul saying, look, the White House is cutting the kinds of deals here that we don't want to see done.
Yeah, that's right. And the White House was asked directly whether they thought this could be a violation of the Logan Act this week, and they really didn't take that question on. So it doesn't look like they are going to be pursuing that angle, and that they see this more as a political dispute with that. One thing, too, I wanted to go back to when we're talking about the AUMF coming out of all of this.
The authorization of military force here, yes?
Yeah. one indication of the relations with Congress and what the White House is really going to be able to accomplish, even on foreign policy. They don't have a single Democrat right now who's come out in support of the president's proposal to pursue the Islamic State militarily. You know, that's pretty extraordinary when you consider, you know, what's happened here and the kind of outrage that this group has engendered here in the United States. But
explain that, Nedra. It's because what Democrats think it gives too much leeway to the White House to pursue military action?
Exactly. And Democrats are voicing concern after you had these very long and costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan about giving a president the authority that's very kind of open-ended to go after Islamic State. Now, the president tried to reach a compromise by saying that this authorization would only last for 3 years, and then the next president would have to go ahead back to Congress to get it renewed if he wanted to keep pursuing this beyond those 3 years, which everyone really expects that this battle would take longer than that. On the other side, you have Republicans saying that this is very restrictive and that the president shouldn't be trying to tie his own hands in pursuing these terrorists. It doesn't allow for ground troops in many situations, and they're also concerned about the time limit.
I want to hear from more listeners. Lots on this. Derek in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Derek, you're on.
Yeah, hi. If there was any doubt as to the attempts of this Republican Congress to tarnish this president and his legacy, there should be no doubt now. They bypass him in inviting Netanyahu 2 weeks before an election just to embarrass him. And then they interject themselves in a foreign policy on a treaty that hasn't even been inked on paper yet, and
but it's not going to come to them, Derek, and that's their complaint. Is that a legitimate complaint?
Yes, but it's unprecedented. You don't form your own foreign policy separate of the president. These are obviously very delicate negotiations.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me the Republicans have no qualms about starting a war with Iran, and if I hope that they are found to break the law, which probably won't happen. But if they broke the law, I would be very happy sending all of them to jail.
That would be a new level of polarization as well. Maybe John, Jack, yeah.
Tom, on this Logan Act business, you know, there is a precedent for the Logan Act, and that is candidate Richard Nixon in 1968 through the widow of Claire Chennault of the Flying Tigers.
Famous World War II era.
Yeah, he effectively sabotaged the peace talks between North and South Vietnam. The question was, would there be a ceasefire there? And through Madame Chennault, and with the help of Henry Kissinger, who was helping the Democratic administration in Paris, Nixon signaled the South Vietnamese leader Thieu that he'd get a better deal if he held off and waited for the new administration. And when Lyndon Johnson found this out, what he said about, quote, Dick Nixon isn't printable, but traitor was the least of it.
John in Stratford, Connecticut. John, you're on.
Yes, what I'd like to say, this reminds me of 2003 before we marched into Iraq, and what a lot of pundits and especially politicians don't dare mention is the influence of AIPAC and AIPAC on these Republicans and these Republican staff Netanyahu speak in front of Congress. And I think that, you know, if what Obama's doing, trying to draw up a plan where we don't have to have military force, is the direction we ought to head.
AIPAC influence you see here. John, I appreciate your call. Of course, yes, the Israeli leader was before Congress. And, of course, Ryan, he said he would not use that as a political weapon, but he is using it apparently in an ad back in Israel now with their elections coming up early next week. There's Netanyahu on television screens in Israel with enthusiastically applauding American Congress before him.
Right, we actually reported on that yesterday. What's ironic is that it is illegal for a U.S. House member or Senate member to use footage of himself or herself, and you know, in their chamber in a campaign ad. Now, Netanyahu assured the country, and House Speaker Boehner assured the country that this was not related to the upcoming Israeli election, but that it was so urgent that he get his point across on the Iran deal that it couldn't wait until after the Israeli election, and that, don't worry, this is not about politics. All of a sudden, now you're seeing the American flag and the U.S. Congress appearing in his campaign ads. After we reported this yesterday, it appears as though he's taken it off of YouTube. Of course, it's still on is still running all across Israel on TV channels there. So here you have the spectacle of the United States Congress being a campaign prop in a foreign government's election.
Joe in Atlanta. Joe, thank you for calling. You're on in Georgia.
Hello, Tom. I'm an Obama supporter from way back, and since Obama won in 2008, I've noticed that there has been a conclusive presumption of illegitimacy in anything that our president does. So these 45 senators sending that letter to me, I think they should be prosecuted, and I ask, what would people have thought of 45 senators writing a letter to Saddam Hussein before we invaded them? That would have been treachery also.
And no thank you, you say. Of course, it's 47, but Joe, we've got it. It is a hot issue, and of course, we'll see what happens with those negotiations in the weeks ahead. That not over, and the White House now saying Republicans want to rush to war, Republicans saying we just want to sign off on this. Well, It is very, very hot material. We've got to go to Ferguson. Lots of resignations there this week as that city tries to come to grips with everything it's been through in recent months. The city manager, the police chief, the municipal judge who was at the heart of things, all out. But then on Thursday, shootings at a demonstration in front of the police station and lots of condemnation. Two policemen shot, reported in serious condition. Now they're out of the hospital. On Thursday, Attorney General Eric Holder condemned those shootings of two police officers in Ferguson.
What happened last night was a pure ambush. This was not someone trying to bring healing to Ferguson. This was the damn punk. Who was trying to sow discord in an area that is trying to get its act together and trying to bring together a community that has been fractured for too long.
A damn punk, says the Attorney General of the United States. Gabe Crocker is head of the St. Louis County Police Officers Association, talked yesterday with NPR, said that the police officers have a difficult job, but these shootings were taking things, he said, to a whole new level.
Situations that are going on in Ferguson and, of course, around the St. Louis region, this isn't really what a lot of people signed up for. You know, this is taking things to a whole new level.
And here's Kat Daniels talking with NPR's Tim Lloyd, saying that the shooting is a tragedy, but that Ferguson residents still have issues and they're going to stay on message.
You know, whoever did that was a coward, but we can't let that take us off message. We need to have a government. We need to have a system that works for all people.
Nedra, this has been crackling with danger and intensity ever since last summer. But for a few days this week, it looked as though it might be headed toward some sort of zone of resolution, or at least a start of that. Now you've got these shootings introduced and the tension right back up again, Nedra. This is dicey territory.
It is. There's been so many ups and downs in Ferguson in the last 10 days because you had the Justice Department issue a long-anticipated report where it found evidence of racial bias. That's why you had all these resignations. And it looked like maybe there could be a chance to move on from all of the protests from last year and have some healing. But this has just really reopened the hostility there. You know, the protesters in particular are concerned that this shooting is an attempt to, or at least the response to it, is an attempt to discredit them. And many of the protesters obviously are disavowing any violence. And they were really angry when the county police chief said that, you know, protesters were among the shooters. And they feel like that this could be a real setback for their movement.
The president talking on Jimmy Kimmel Live last night, give you a kind of a sense of how seriously it's all being taken. Here's President Obama addressing the shooting.
What had been happening in Ferguson was oppressive and objectionable and was worthy of protest. But there was no excuse for criminal acts.
Ryan Grimm, it's a long time since I felt this level of racial tension in the air in this country. You don't want to make too much of it. On the other hand, Everybody's watching Ferguson. It's becoming a kind of litmus test with a very big national audience now.
Right, and Ferguson is just one small municipality, you know, outside of St. Louis. But you know, if you kicked over logs, all across the country, I think you'd find the same kind of thing, same kind of tensions crawling underneath. You know, this is what you get when you combine a history of racism with what's called, you know, revenue-driven policing. In other words, these municipalities or towns, instead of taxing their residents, they decide that they're going to use their kind of monopoly of over violence that they have, and they're going to pull over residents, or they're going to they're going to seize assets, and they're going to hit them with a bunch of little ticky-tack fines, which might start out at $50, $100, $200, but they end up being quite debilitating for the population that is victimized by them, and overwhelmingly in Ferguson and elsewhere, that's African Americans.
And of course, this all comes in the same week as we saw that really rough video out of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity. What, bus ride, University of Oklahoma, caught just a snippet of this racist chant on a chartered bus.
There'll never be a saint.
That bleeping, of course, N-word there. There will never be that at this fraternity, says the chant. Hanging from a tree, sort of lynching talk right there. The response from the University of Oklahoma was fast, and it was very firm. Here was the University President David Boren, very quick to condemn the video, cut off this fraternity, take very hard action in Oklahoma. Here he is Monday, speaking to a crowd of students at a campus rally.
I have a message for those who have misused their free speech in this way. My message to them is, you're disgraceful. You have violated every principle that this university stands for.
The video was harsh. The response was very clear and firm. Kelly in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma, Kelly, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad to be a part of this conversation. As a twice graduate of OU, I got my bachelor's and my Juris Doctor degree there. Yes. I just wanted to say that I was so proud of President Boren for his response and his action. He is an example for other influential leaders to follow in instances where there's racism like this.
Kelly, were people shocked in Oklahoma City? You as an alum, were you shocked to see this, or was it sort of known or presumed that was that kind of attitude was still out there?
I was definitely shocked. I did not receive this type of treatment when I was at OU. I received a very warm embrace. I was in the extreme minority when I was there, but I was not treated this way.
What do you think about the general tenor of race relations in this country now, Kelly? You saw a strong response there from the University of Oklahoma. They've gotten a lot of plaudits for that. On the other hand, here we've got Ferguson still festering along and a lot of concern about it. What do you see, Kelly?
And that's why I think it was so great that President Boren responded the way he did. He did it at the exact perfect time. He struck while the iron was hot, because we're just starting to talk about it more. It's not that it wasn't there. It was always there. But now the conversation is just hot.
Kelly, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, if Ferguson and the greater St. Louis area had been as clear and firm on these kinds of problems as the University of Oklahoma, we might not be in this tough situation here all these months after last summer's trouble.
Yes, the systemic tax farming that went on there would not have been able to continue if there had been that level of indignation. But you know, there's an issue here, and it goes to Selma. Really, Selma was about voting, and in 2012, in that election, 55%, I believe it was, of African Americans in Ferguson voted. A few months later, in April of 2013, 6% voted in the municipal elections. And a lot of people point to that and say, this is one of the ways in which municipalities, that is, by scheduling their elections in off years, this is one of the ways that municipalities and their power structures stay in power. Because the big turnout comes when the president is running, and then in off years you get 6% show up. Now there's an election coming up in a couple of weeks in Ferguson, and people, you know, I think there may be another black councilor may win. I don't know, but it will be something to see if there's a turnout proportionate to the population. Because if there is, that city council will be turned out. If there isn't, it'll be another victory for the politics of sort of induced apathy that surrounds so many municipal elections.
Boy, if this last couple of seasons doesn't pull out the black vote, I don't know what would. That's a way toward change. Jack Beattie, please stand by. Nedra Pickler with the Associated Press. Ryan Grimm with the Huffington Post. We're looking at a week in the news. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, an Army Black Hawk down off Florida in heavy fog, 7 Marines and 4 soldiers on board. Here's Colonel Monty Cannon of Eglin Air Force Base yesterday.
At this time, I can report that we have located the wreckage of the UH-60 Black Hawk that was reported missing Tuesday evening. At this point, we are not hopeful for survivors.
Not hopeful for survivors, and it has been days now. Co-creator of The Simpsons, Sam Simon, has died at 59, leaving behind characters like evil nuclear power plant owner Mr. Burns, who had this greeting for his employees on Monday morning.
Time to pay for your 2 days of debauchery, you hungover drones.
Oh, great. And a big music verdict says Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke and Pharrell ripped off Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up. Here they are, back to back. Jury says, too close. 7 million plus goes to Marvin Gaye's family. We're looking at a week in the news. The GOP's Iran letter, Hillary Clinton meets the press, Ferguson, Oklahoma, and more. You can join us. Nedra Pickler joins us, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, and our own Jack Beattie. I want to go to Hillary Clinton's appearance at the United Nations this week. She chose that venue to talk about all the controversy over her use of a private email set up when she was Secretary of State. Here she is saying, talking about why she deleted some of her private emails instead of providing copies to the State Department.
At the end, I chose not to keep my private personal emails, emails about planning Chelsea's wedding or my mother's funeral arrangements, condolence notes to friends, as well as yoga routines, family vacations, the other things you typically find in inboxes.
Nothing to look at here. And she said what she did was acceptable under the law at that time. Tom Blanton, the director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, spoke with NPR's All Things Considered on Wednesday. When NPR correspondent Brian Naylor played a clip from Hillary Clinton's press conference, Blanton said he disagreed with her analysis.
The laws and regulations in effect when I was Secretary of State allowed me to use my email for work. That is undisputed.
No.
Tom Blanton is director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University in Washington.
The laws and regulations, in effect, discouraged the use of personal email for official business.
Well, that sounds like a very definitive no, Ryan Grimm. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton says they allowed me to use her email for work, and the head of the National Security Archive says that it was discouraged. Maybe that's just enough wiggle room, Ryan.
You do see the Clintons often getting themselves tangled up in these disputes over whether or not what they did was technically illegal or not, which would be great if they're, you know, in front of a judge or a jury. But, this is a political campaign. So, whether or not what you did might somehow skirt past regulations isn't quite the point. You know, is what you did the best conduct that you could have carried out as Secretary of State, as the representative, the top foreign diplomat for the United States. And you know, as many people have pointed out, this goes to one of the skepticisms that people have about the Clintons, this penchant for secrecy and this kind of urge to ask for forgiveness rather than permission.
Nedra Pickler, is the White House, I mean, ultimately it's Democrats who will choose a candidate for the presidency in the 2016 race and American voters who will ultimately decide here. Is the White House having much of anything to say about this email use when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State for Barack Obama?
Well, let me just start by saying that if the University of Oklahoma President Boren's quick response to the scandal there was a textbook case of how you should handle crisis communication. Hillary Clinton had a textbook example of how you should not, waiting so many days to respond. And that put the White House in the most uncomfortable and awkward position for days of being the only voice to respond to questions on this. And, you know, they had a really tough job because they don't want to criticize her. She's mm-hmm. likely to be the nominee of their party. But at the same time, they made it clear that she wasn't following what they called very specific guidance that government officials should use government email to conduct official business. And this really dominated the White House briefing for days on end.
Ryan, what about the argument that lots of politicians use private email and Hillary Clinton's being singled out, kind of swift-boated here before she even announces?
Well, first of all, they often do retreat to this argument that other people have done wrong. And so, why are you, harassing Hillary Clinton about this? On the other hand, for one, it's not the case that that so many public officials exclusively use personal email. That's the difference here. It's one thing if some public officials have personal email and they have work email and sometimes the two overlap. It's another thing entirely to only use personal email and to say that, well, it's okay because when I emailed people who worked for the State Department, they were following the rules, and so therefore, therefore my emails would be captured in the system, which is like saying I don't have to follow those rules because others did, and she has some sort of herd immunity protection. But what if everyone decided to go the way that Hillary Clinton did, and you had nobody using state.gov email accounts? And as she herself said, in hindsight, she wishes that she had done it differently. But why is that so difficult? And a lot of Democrats are upset at being put in the position of constantly having to defend the Clintons, and they keep asking themselves, why can't you just make better decisions and not put us into this position so regularly?
Let me go to Robert in Lake Placid, if I may. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Robert. You're on.
My thoughts on this are that being a public official and using her own hard drive, that full disclosure should be done by a third party, and that anything that's on there, whether it's personal or public, should be known by this third party to say whether this is, business for the politicians or this is her personal email. And I feel that, there's no full transparency with any of this because she is in complete control of this hard drive, which if anybody else was to do that, they would be scolded and scorned and probably have charges put up against them.
Robert, let us pick it up. Jack Beatty, Hillary Clinton says, no, that's my hard drive, and I'm not handing it over for people to rummage around in there. Our caller in Lake Placid says he wants an independent third party, not her staffers going through to decide what's what.
Well, I think other people are asking for that. You know, one of the more ludicrous points she made in that very defensive defense of her record was that, this server is at my house in Chappaqua, and it's protected by the Secret Service. Well, that's not the issue. the object, the issue is it available for a cyber espionage? She just went right by that. You know, Tom, at the bottom of this, you can really see her feelings about the press. Look, someone who works for us said, she hates you, period. That's never going to change. Maggie Haberman and company for Politico last year did a piece talking with scores of her people, and they concluded as much as anything else, her ambivalence about the race, about running, they told us, reflects her distaste for and apprehension of a rapacious, shallow, and sometimes outright sexist national political press corps acting as enablers of her enemies on the right. That she is, and so I think if she had told the truth to the press and said, yes, I did this because I didn't want any of you to see anything that I had written, I think it would have been much closer to the truth. And it would have put put to the fore her, is it paranoid? Probably, but also in some ways justified loathing and distrust of the media glare.
I wonder if it's really the media driving all this. I mean, people want to know what's going on with the Secretary of State. Ryan, what about the politics here? The Democratic Party, she is the presumed nominee. She hasn't announced yet. How are party people taking this? Is there talk of needing somebody else in the primaries or on the go?
There is a lot of talk, but you need somebody. It's quite a peculiar situation where, she is by far the front runner, more than 50 points ahead of anybody else. But there really isn't anybody else running. There barely is a bench. Elizabeth Warren is the one that the left would love to see jump in. She's shown no interest so far in following that, despite the fact that there's kind of a national draft Warren campaign that even has offices set up in New Hampshire and Iowa. And then you have a group of folks like Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who people don't really consider a kind of a plausible, front-running presidential candidate. And so you have this spectacle of Hillary Clinton just possibly being able to stumble her way all the way to the convention and become coronated.
Nedra Pickler, Jack raises Hillary's defense that she had Secret Service protection at her home in New York, so everything's all right. But Secret Service in the news, of course, this week because things haven't even looked all right around the White House. What is it that happened, Nedra, that's just coming to light this week?
Well, this is pretty extraordinary. This is apparently last week there was a party for the Secret Service spokesman, Ed Donovan, who ironically has been the person out publicly responding to so many of the Secret Service security breaches that have come up in recent months. He's retiring, and they were having a party, and two very high-ranking agents apparently left the party after drinking, went back to the White House, and they ran through a security barrier that had been set up for a suspicious package. And they actually, according to the great reporting that's been done on the Washington Post in this, pulled their car right up next to this package that, as they were waiting for, bomb detecting equipment to determine if it was a bomb. A woman had just thrown it there out of her car saying that it was a bomb. To make matters even worse, some of the officers on the scene apparently wanted to give them sobriety tests and arrest them. And apparently one of the commanding officers there said to let them go home. And this is a real test for the new director of the Secret Service, James Clancy. The president named him as director here last month, against the advice of an outside panel that said that the Secret Service is too insular and needs some outside leadership. James Clancy is a very well-respected but longtime agent who's been on the presidential detail. So this is a real question of whether Director Clancy is going to be able to make the changes there that are necessary.
How close were these agents or to President Obama? I mean, these were, as you say, pretty senior, not just out walking the far White House fence.
Yeah, that's true. The president knew both of these agents. There have been photos of one of them standing right next to him, guarding him on overseas trips. He was the number two on his detail. And then the other agent, he actually was high-ranking in the Washington field office. And ironically, this agent, his name is George Ogilvy, had put out a statement in response to the drinking on the job allegations on some presidential trips, saying that there would be zero tolerance of this type of behavior, and that should apply to not just rank-and-file personnel, but the Secret Service managers and leadership. And here he himself is now caught up in one of these scandals.
Jack Beattie, our time is short. Of course, talking about Joe Clancy there. overseeing this or trying to. We've got the president dealing with pretty big stuff in the world and right in his backyard, his own Secret Service running into his own security barriers.
Yes, and according to an important Washington Post story of last fall, it may be that there's a grave morale crisis in the Secret Service because of a White House cover-up, and that is to the prostitution scandal in Colombia. An overnight guest in another hotel, a member of the presidential advance team setting it up, there is some evidence that he had a prostitute, too. He was not investigated. He was not punished. And about two dozen Secret Service agents and members of the military were. And from what the Post says, this has really roiled the Secret Service. And I don't know whether it's damaged their morale or not. The young man was a son of a donor to the Obama campaign. It was on the eve of the campaign. And there was some subsidiary scandal around it. Do our White House people know about this?
Nedra?
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that came out last month, and the White House has said basically that they don't have any evidence that this young man was involved with a prostitute, but it's really an open question of what went down there. We may never actually know the facts on that one.
Nedra Pickler with the Associated Press covering the White House. Thank you so much for being with us today, Nedra.
My pleasure.
And Ryan Grimm with Huffington Post in Washington. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
I want to hear a little more from the president. He made a big speech in Selma, Alabama, last weekend. Here he was. He said, 239 years after the nation's founding, our union is not yet perfect.
But we are getting closer. Our job's easier because somebody already got us through that first mile. Somebody already got us over that bridge. When it feels the road's too hard, when the torch we've been passed feels too heavy, we will remember these early travelers and draw strength from their example.
Tough days this week sometimes, and inspiring words this week as well. We want to remember that. A special goodbye today to our terrific longtime colleague here at On Point, producer Sam Gale Rosen. Sam has been a rock and an inspiration to all of us. He's headed out on new trails, and we wish him all the best. We will miss his wisdom and his creativity. Sam Gale Rosen, it's been great working with you. Good luck. Go out with Marvin Gaye, Got to Give It Up. His family won their suit this week against Pharrell. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.